Blog Talk Radio.
It's as complicated as we need to make it. If we are defining this understanding of something beyond comprehension, beyond even our own grasp, as well educated or over educated as we might be, then the exploration, the work that we do to achieve understanding will be a measure of that turbulence, of that tension. And yet, here today, I'm able to talk about this at arm's length and suggest that if we begin to realize that we have a capability inside, in our minds, in our person, to find a simple and beautiful answer to the questions that we need to answer for ourselves. If we believe that, yet accept that we might not know in the moment exactly how to put our finger on that, then our task becomes, can become quite like a sigh, It's accepting. It is what it is. It's not more complicated because we're anxious about it, or less complicated because we're bold and attack it with all of our vigor. But to search for something and value it without trivializing the whole process, I think that can be done. That can be done. And can it be simplified? Can we simplify something so complicated? Well, I think by necessity, we see examples of that around us all the time, and reasonably can ask, why not me? Why really? If we are each able to overcome our own conceits and our own difficulties, this mountain that I climb is so much steeper than yours, so much more perilous. There's so many more elements that I'm fighting than you. Oh, if only I had all of the benefits. If I was born into royalty, I would be in a sublime state of mind. If only I had a command of the material world, I would be transparently happy. I would be fulfilled, wouldn't I? No. Except there's no evidence of that anywhere. None. And there's a bit of the an admonishment that, you know, to watch what you wish for, because it might come true. Being able to handle the unexpected, the things that occur around us, and do that with some grace and poise without seeming too foolish is, and I think it gets into accepting ourselves and taking a good hard look and understanding the kind of person that we really are, not as we want ourselves to be seen, but as the world around us sees. What's that person that everybody else lives with? The cheesy sense of humor, the rudeness, all those types of things that we're quite capable of doing from time to time. Nietzsche did this for us, didn't he? In his work. I've been reading a little bit more about his work lately. When everything else seems so joyous, so optimistic. I don't know if we could say his work was that of a pessimist, but it wasn't, you know, he wasn't caught up in this in sort of neo-Christian view of whether there is a God or not, although he's, you know, often cited for that, there is no God, but God is dead. He was a cautious man. Came from a very pious upbringing, and was expected to step into the role of his father as a Christian, but found that wasn't satisfying enough, and went on to question a great deal. But there is a clarity and honesty in it. I think if it's not pessimism that drives, that raises the allows us to raise the question, isn't it just the sense that some degree of relief would be nice, some to put it all on pause, to find the tranquility around. Well, another day I'll talk to you about antagonism, the agonies. You know, the reality. We escape that as humanity has doing thousands of years, attempting the escape. To look into the face of the Creator, to commune with creation. We are left with is so incredibly valuable and And it really does test the notion that all questions are have an answer. Maybe out there somewhere in the ether, but not close enough for it to mean anything for us today. But knowing that the balances that we're looking to for that we need in our lives is possible, and that may come in a moment without notice, may be around us if we choose to look for it. I guess I think I notice how angry people seem to be when they have achieved their sense of rightness, how murderous they seem to feel, how ready to justify the aggression. It's a curiosity, isn't it? Well, in ways, of course, that are only for a few curious minds, the order doesn't provide answers as much as provides processes. May not be able to tell us the truths. You know, you just bash old Hiram on the head and knock his brains out and have at it. That's birth, middle age, and death of it all. No, it's what we're doing is, and you get frank and you grow. It's like growing up. You see the world, hopefully, as it truly is, and then rise above it instead of feeling overwhelmed. I think it's natural when we're younger to feel, when we notice these things, to feel overwhelmed. Unless we're consumed accepting the ideas of other people around us. No, I'm talking about that departure when character starts to emerge. You know, personality starts to grow and expand. And it goes on, we know. There's a bit of science to it. It goes on into our 30s. Processes. Imagine that some of those processes, known and unknown to us, are still at play. If only we could all find the simplicity. Not that would be joyful. I don't know that. I'm told that, but I don't know that. I think compared to chaos, it would be an advantage some days. I don't know if it leads to that feeling inside. I don't think it does. I think understanding is something, there's another emotion that goes with that. Not really sure what that emotion is. That process of revealing and understanding. I am. The better part is knowing the questions never end. We can't really explain how some dedicate themselves, how others seem to be looking at this kind of firm resolve with just out of the corner of their eye. As if it's not really there, but it is there. Fortunately, we're taught a discipline. Yeah. But being for me, it's teaching you to walk up to a piano and just bash away, make sound, make noise, and we'll call that music. Just bash away. But do that every day. And I want you, I'd like you to do that for as long as you're at the start. Let's say a half an hour and then an hour. And then just bash away. Make whatever sound comes out. We'll call it music. And yet, as satisfying as that might be in a visceral sense, it's hard to communicate that, to transfer that. Every day would be a different bashing of noise. So I would teach, I would instruct you to practice patterns to be able to understand what we call reading, organizing your thinking about these noises that you make with each key. And then to be taught that these collections of noises can be made purposeful, and then that we can express emotion in the music. Oh. Imagine encouraging a student to go inside themselves for that. Once you know it's there, it's like I take you into a gallery and put you in the spot before this beautiful, beautiful, inspiring piece of art and say to you, you know, most people are profound, but are overwhelmed by the pathos of this work. And I'm going to leave you here with your thoughts on that and come back. What do you think would happen? You'd search for that, would you? Or would you say, oh, bloody hell, you know, what's he gone on about now? But what if you trusted the person? What if you wanted to understand the pathos and how the artist, you wanted to understand how the artist did that? What is it about this series of notes? What is it about the brush strokes, the color? What is it about that connection? The vulnerability, you're connecting with something that other people don't know about you. That sense of the expression of anguish, and the story that it tells about ourselves. I think you'll find, although these stories and notions aren't often explained in your lodge or my lodge, the work gives us that opportunity. Whether we meditate on it or digest it as we walk along, it's enriching. What do we do with trends? Well, trends come and trends go. You know, popular is transitory. It's never permanent. It's popular. It's popular because there's a novelty to it. And we know about novelty. With ideas, novelty is, you know, about 30 days. That's about all we can do. And then we sort of punk out about that. But, and we work with those ideas, when, particularly when we're working with that raw energy of the mind of a child. It doesn't stop, by the way, as we put in our time on the planet. No, we were told that you're an old fool, there's no more that you need learn. So as we kick off the show today, I'd like you just to keep a notion in mind. And I'll illustrate this a bit in a couple of weeks when I've worked through the ideas. Is there anything left to be thought? Is there anything left to be said that hasn't already been thought and said? Well, there's always. But on an individual level, what is it? What is it that that remaking. I guess it's like saying, "Do we? Is there another color? I can't paint because of, I have to discover a new color variation." And here's somebody, I think, overthinking the process. It's the combination, blend it. What brush are you going to use there? And what will the brush stroke be like? Tell me about the light. I hope you sit back and enjoy, fill your or stein or your glass of port or your sip of brandy, or join me with a cappuccino or two and just savor the moment. We'll start with a bit of music. This is from Eddie Higgins, and Scott Hamilton is sitting in on it. It's an interesting little piece. Eh? Smoke gets in your eyes, remember that?
Thank you.
There we go again. That just doesn't. How do you start off a program of ideas with material like that? That's just not right. It does tend to focus the mind, though, doesn't it? Our commentary today is about relevance, reasoning. I know that's an easy one to pick out as a Freemason. Coming to grips with reason, living a life of where you've reasoned through, you're understand, you've tried to come to some validation. Become aware of these enormously interesting ideas. There's not just one way. When I still go back to, you know, sitting back, reading, reflecting on Aristotle, I think, oh my goodness, there's so many wonderful ideas in there. But then, if I only would stop there, yeah, I guess the curse is not knowing when to finish the painting. I'm one of those kind of artists, or was. Now I just change perspective. I can look at that daffodil and paint it repeatedly, and it's never the same twice. Relevance in a material world. Ooh. What could possibly be more important than what's on your mind at the moment? Why then does it seem so baseless to bow to the gods of materialism in a world with so much deprivation? If you've wondered this, you're not alone. Being a man of conscience places before us dilemma after dilemma until it dawns on us some problems are bigger than one person. Some questions don't have immediate answers. Some things bring on our sense of compassion. Others trigger conspicuousness. I can load a car with thousands of dollars worth of equipment to get away and commune with nature, to get in touch, only to return to the start line again and again, asking the same questions, but at different times in life. What is important today? Let me ask you in a decade, and then a decade on, and then in the last day of your life. In my mind, each time you answer will reveal your progress. Until the last, when unencumbered, you reveal to yourself and us what is the important. Compassion, as science has shown, generates a mindset that is beneficial to longevity and quality of life. It eases the mind. A smile and sense of humor hastens healing. Does it really matter how that happens or that it happens? It is how we become comfortable with self-discipline within that same lodge. Because we have learners not yet accomplished in their work who stumble before ingratiating themselves. We accept in this form the reverence of ritual. It defines and challenges us. While it will be dissected for meaning, it is not the end of that pilgrimage, but the start. What makes it work for you? What bearing? What presence of mind? The relevance you make of it. Here we share time to influence one and the other, rubbing shoulders with inspired people, sure to inspire us. Collecting our thoughts.
Thank you.
like to think of John Coltrane as an appetizer for just about anything that follows. If there is merit to poetry, if you begin to wonder if there are certain realities and truths and notions around us that to be discovered, then perhaps the avant-garde isn't so much the avant-garde. Perhaps poetry isn't ennui. Maybe there is something that the poet draws from the soul of the world. Today, I'm tipping into the work of T.S. Eliot. He's considered modernist, as if the Victorian era poetry came to an end and a new form emerged. Eliot represents that new form. This is a guy that was born in 1888 in St. Louis, Missouri, and he died in 1965 in London, England. He was considered he's the editor of the modernist movement in poetry. He had a strong influence on Anglo-American culture from the 1920s until late the century. The men and women who taught me must have missed that. They must have been napping during that influence. But he experimented in diction and style and versification, and he made English poetry. He brought a keenness to it, almost as if he revitalized it. So he did a series of essays, as he's wont to do. But today, we're looking at one of his more iconic pieces, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. It's about the city man. It's considered a hallmark in English poetry because it's a break. The man, Alfred J. Prufrock, is presented with a sense of despair and passivity of a middle-aged man. He's in love, but his love song is never sung. He meditates too much. His cowardice is his Achilles heel. He's haunted by the problem whether he should reveal his love to the lady, and he is undone. The poem's typically not of the 20th century, but of all ages. It deals with emotional frustration, despair, hollowness of human beings at any period of history. But this, Eliot's love song, does not sing in praise of love. The title of the poem raises our expectations that in this work we'll hear how a lover lays bare his heart at the feet of his beloved. Nothing of that sort happens in this poem. The title of the poem is moronic. The point of calling this poem a love song lies in the irony that it will never be sung. Prufrock will never dare to voice what he feels. This poem is an investigation of the disturbed consciousness of the typical modern man. He's overeducated, powerful, anxious, emotionally artificial. Speaker of the poem, Prufrock, is addressing a lover with whom he would like to know to somehow consummate their relationship, but he cannot dare to approach the woman. He starts hearing the remarks others make about his weaknesses. He becomes conscious of his growing age and unkempt clothing. He rarely thinks of himself in cannot enjoy even a peach. He does not have the courage to do anything in life except thinking. And in the end, he hears the mermaids singing for each other, and he surely knows they won't sing to him. I won't read it all. It's just a long piece. But think about what pulls at you as you go through this piece. Eh? Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once around the house and fell asleep. And indeed, there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back against the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And I've known the arms already, known them all. Arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, down with light brown hair. Is it perfume from her dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl. Should I then presume, and how should I begin? Shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. And would it have been worth it after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me? Would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I'm Lazarus, come from the dead. Come back to tell you all. I shall tell you all. If one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. No, I'm not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I'm an attendant, Lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or to advise the prince, no doubt an easy tool. Deferential, glad to be of use. Politic, cautious, meticulous, full of high sentence and a bit obtuse. At times, indeed, almost ridiculous. And almost at times, the fool. I do not think that they will sing for me. I've seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back. When the wind blows the water white and black, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea by seagulls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. Man living in his own head. Well, he's not the only one.
I'll be in a calzone.
Little ad thrown in. Why not, hey? Here. Morgan Jacobs is an interesting historian. The perspectives she brings forward are remarkable. We're bringing out the history, a narrative from the about and from the 18th century. At least we hope it is. And we hope that her work is reasonably accurate. I think it has some accuracy because she uses touchstones of history, findings, but as a good historian does, she pulls us into a story. She claims in Masonic rhetoric, behavior, not birth, ultimately determined the character and virtue of a brother. By implication, even hierarchy is a man-made invention. within this sociable meritocracy lies the first self-conscious attempt to create societies governed by the abstract principle of British constitutionalism. Well, was what it was. And predictably, the lodges required literacy of their members. But perhaps most important, relative affluence was necessary to pay the dues, a few pounds at initiation, and then a few shillings each month. In addition, the membership records from the earliest official London lodges are noticeably high in Fellows of the Royal Society, government ministers, Whig aristocrats, journalists, and of interest for the Continental story recounted in later Huguenot refugees with journalistic or political connections. At a time when the political nations would be defined as one out of five males who held sufficient property to vote, as well as those literate enough to follow the pamphlets that parliamentary politics encouraged, membership in 18th century lodges tended to be confined to such men. The emergence of this particular private society, modeled on and indeed deriving from the Masonic guilds of medieval origin, should be understood in relation to an important moment in the history of European political development. For much of Europe, urban history, guilds of craftsmen and even of merchants provided, as one historian aptly describes it, the counterculture to civil society. The guilds were virtual participants in town and city life. They functioned to protect their members from the power of the great magistrates, lay and ecclesiastical. Their understanding of freedom and equality was more protectionist and collective than it was individual and purely market. Yet with these qualifications, the guilds also played a regulatory role in the commercial life of any city, operating both protectively and coercively in ways that have been described as ideal to police the workforce. The guilds regulated who might practice his mystery, that is, the skills of a particular craft, at any given moment and place. The relationship between the guild and the free merchant was partly adversarial, partly collaborative. But their relation to actual governmental authority in urban settings was significantly different. Guilds might administer the policies of local magistrates, but they did not make these policies, although they might indeed be carefully consulted. In early 18th century Britain, there was, in one sense, nothing counterculture about the new speculative lodges. They embraced the rhetoric of constitutional authority and the magistrates seated in Parliament. That our time together is almost up for another week. Moment of reflection. I'm always happy to share it. It's interesting that we share it and yet we have this sense of isolation, don't we? Privacy. We're allowed to sit with our own thoughts. We can reflect or not. But the struggle here, I think we're talking about a masonry that's not antagonistic. No, the acrimony that might happen when personalities chafe against one another, we can approach ourselves with it, with that idealism and that wonderful sense of humor. Oh, the old idiot. I think he's had a snootful before he came tonight. Only it's different when we say it as something encouraging, isn't it? About somebody that we love, silly old bugger. Vitality of this just sharpens our pencil. As we go about our business, if we have a thought for ourselves and what we see, perhaps these conversations here on Masonic Effects or the sharing of ideas from poets and philosophers and through history will provide you with a context more consistent with your character, with your abilities. That private connection. I will never know that. Nobody else will. The only way you will reveal that, and the only way we will know is by your behavior, by observation. The self-same measure that you use. Compared to the alternatives, even the need for calculation, the constant need for calculation in Freemasonry. There's no score for this play. No, we're writing it as we go along. And we're writing the plot line too, in a way. Only we have such complexity that after we are given these protections, you know, the constitutional protections, and after we learn about the ancient landmarks, then, of course, we begin to notice whether those around us have done the same, how they've prepared themselves or not. And we see the things that are normal about human nature, they're all there. It's all there. You know, the pettiness and the need for recognition, it's all there. But we also see something else. And as you go about your business, we see the enthusiasm for the hunt, the earnestness of the trip, the pilgrimage, that searching for that goal, that inner peace, coming to terms with the your creator, a creator, completing the equation in a way. We've been a small part of that, then we've served some purpose. Thank you for serving your purpose and being such a wonderful, attentive audience. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And if you can, do it anonymously. It's just the thrill of it all. I look forward to being with you again soon. Peace. Disaster became me. It made me as a fool to be. Almost blue. Almost touching it will almost do.
pardon me, that's always true. Always. That you promise with your eyes, I see yours too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Oh.